Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Just the Facts. That was a weird hello. Hello, how are you? Yep, welcome to Just the Facts. That sounds better. The podcast that features candid conversations with your favourite actors and filmmakers. And welcome to episode 21. How are you doing? Good? I hope so. And if not, I certainly hope today's episode is going to change that because I have a fantastic guest today. A brilliant filmmaker, actor, writer, director. This guy does it all, and in the process, and in an incredibly short amount of time, like 4 years, has built up an amazing CV of films. So if you're listening to this episode, there is every chance you already know the work of Jim Cummings, inside and out. Maybe better than me. I discovered him 2018 with his, in inverted commas, debut feature, Thunder Road. We'll get into why I'm doing inverted commas right now in the interview. But I loved Thunder Road. Then obviously The Wolf of Snow Hollow, loved that as well. But today we're going to be spending a great deal of time talking about his latest feature, The Beta Test. It came out in cinemas in the UK on Friday, just gone. It is out now. You can go see this in a cinema, and I cannot recommend it enough. It's a brilliant psychological thriller, come black comedy, come horror, come satire on the entertainment industry. It's wild. It's one of those movies that you have to just experience yourself. It's wild. It's wild. That's the best way to describe it. It's set in this changing landscape of Hollywood against the backdrop of the ousting of this toxic masculinity culture that has pervaded there for so long. It's also about a whole load of other stuff and a guy played by Jim stuck in the middle of it all. Look, I mean, this is why I didn't want to try and explain it, because it is a movie you need to go and see yourself, but go and see it, you should, because it is fantastic. You'll hear all about it in our chat today. That is coming up in like 30 seconds time. Very quickly, our little bit of housekeeping to do first. Do follow us on Twitter and Instagram at JTFpod for all the details on the show. And of course, congratulations to some of the people who do follow us at JTF Pod. Jessica White, Ben, Laura Jackson, Daniel Herrera, Jad Samur, Tom Boyd Hall, Ali Billet, MovieFest UK, I Am Grout, and Devesh Sood all worked out from the clues on our social media that Jim Cummings is my guest today. I think we might have to start making that clue a bit harder, because that is an ever-growing list as more and more people discover the show, which is great, but work it out. So I don't want to stop congratulating the people who do. We're going to have to make the clues harder. That's something that's going to have to happen. Don't forget, you can watch this full interview in glorious Technicolor on our Just the Facts Pod YouTube channel, JTF Pod YouTube channel, on Friday. And also, why not visit our rather special new website that my producer Grant built for us? It's wonderful. And sign up for our newsletter to become part of our lovely little Just the Facts community. If you do like the show, please take the time to rate and review us. It's a massive help on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. But let's do this, yeah? Please welcome to Just the Facts the supremely talented Jim Cummings.
How do I sound? Do I sound okay?
You actually sound fantastic. Yeah. Do you know what? Thank you for asking, because some people don't bother to ask. And I, you know, it's that British thing. I sometimes go, oh, I feel too embarrassed to bring it up. So then I don't bring it up. And then I spend probably, you know, longer than I need to editing, trying to fix it. But you sound good.
Yeah, that's what I've realized directing in my early career was being too nice to people at the expense of the product. And yeah, don't do that. Be mean if it means that the thing is going to be better.
Yeah, I know. But then you run the risk sometimes. Like, for example, sometimes people have got the lighting how they want it because they've decided this is how I look best. And then you don't want to blunder in at the start of an interview and make it awkward by going, sorry, could you open the curtains or something? Just get some more natural light on your face, because they're sort of like on the back foot, because they're like, I thought I looked good like this. They have to relight themselves. It's a sensitive, who knew how sensitive an experiment Zoom would be?
Yeah, the benefit with me is that I always look like shit. So we don't have to worry about that.
That, sir, is not true. Where are you? Where are you at the moment? I'm in London.
I am on the east side of LA. I'm coming to London on the 10th. They're going to screen the movie A Bunch of the Prince Charles, and I'm going to go schlep around to a bunch of different theaters to say hi to people. I'm in the east side of LA, kind of close to the Hollywood sign, ironically.
Oh, okay. I was going to say that's... And that is home, right? That you're not just there at the moment. That's home for you.
No, yeah, this is my garage. We finished the movie in this room on the computer I'm talking you through.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think I read that at the end of the credits, like finished on an Adobe program. I won't pretend I know which, but...
All of them. Yeah. We use exclusively Creative Cloud, which is just kind of a bulk, user-friendly, pro-consumer, you know, product suite. And it's not the special kind of Pro Tools or anything that you'd use to make a big movie. We just did it entirely out of the box, which is fun.
That's amazing. Because if you hadn't told me that, there is no discernible difference in the quality of your film with, I guess, you know, for want of a better example, a Marvel MCU movie. It looks as good.
It's crazy. And we shot it for $250,000 American. So like it's doubly strange that the movie looks like a huge budget movie, but we were able to do it in a backyard and in our offices.
No, wait. So the budget, so just to clarify, the budget for the beta test was $250,000 American dollars.
Yeah.
That's insane. That's nothing. I mean, that's what do they even call that? That's like not even mini budget. That's like micro budget.
They call that SAG ultra low. Thunder Road, my first feature, was $190,000. And then we went and made a werewolf film with an American studio with MGM called The Wolf of Snow Hollow. And that was $2 million. And then we've gone back to making smaller budget movies that we have complete creative control over.
Yeah. So you didn't have complete creative control over The Wolf of Snow Hollow? Because I love that. I love that movie, by the way. In my book, you're 3 for 3, which is a great CV to have right now.
Thanks so much. That means a lot. With Wolf of Snow Hollow, we had like done the movie and we all agreed to do the script that we set out to do. And then we started pulling at the threads of the sweater in the edit. it was difficult. You know, when you make a movie that's that big, you have 60 people on set at any given time. And there's a good quote from David Fincher. He says he showed up on day one of Alien 3 and realized that a union dolly grip doesn't want to push a dolly for a 29-year-old. And I learned that lesson very hard in the snowy hills of Utah. But no, seriously, it was, you know, any time that we wanted to get a scene with six shots, we probably got five if we were lucky. And it's just so big. There's so many people. It's like taking an aircraft carrier to the grocery store. So let alone not being able to touch the camera and all the rules that you have of not doing an independent film. It was a very different kind of diplomacy that we had to have on that set. And then on the next one, my producers promised me I'd have complete creative control and I would be able to edit the film. And so I edited the film for 16 months and that became the beta test.
That's great. I mean, to go back to that David Fincher quote, that's an interesting idea. I remember reading about it was, to go back to your initial point about, you know, you can't just be nice and let the film suffer. I remember James Cameron, when he was shooting Aliens over here, found that the crew over here were not, you know, particularly receptive to an American director coming in and telling them how it worked. They were like, this is our tea break, mate. We have a tea break right now. And, you know, he did not pull his punches metaphorically when it came to getting shit done.
Yeah. James is a really weird guy and is notorious for being a huge prick on set sometimes. Yeah. I mean, obviously he's made the biggest movies ever and some of the best movies ever made. And I'm sure, you know, Hitchcock was probably the same. I'm sure Andrea Arnold gets pissed at times on set and needs the film to be what it needs to be. I'm a Buddhist. I like don't have that kind of anger in me. I use my characters for that stuff. And it comes out through the performances. But no, it's a challenging thing. Most people want to be nice. And it's an instinct that I have as well. But sometimes it will just hurt the scenes. And I just, at a certain point, you have to go, well, why are we doing this? Like the movie's not going to be good. We have to make sure that the movie's good.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what we're talking about here and perhaps the behavior of certain directors historically, famously in the past, you know, does kind of tie in with some of the themes of the beta tester and what was acceptable then and how it isn't now.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, it is a very different landscape in Hollywood now for the better. And these toxic, masculine, type A pricks are no longer welcome in the community and they have to pretend to be these nice guys. and it's really funny to watch. There's a good quote from my producer, Ben, who says, if something needs correcting, you can expect an overcorrection. And that's what we're seeing in Hollywood right now.
So to go back to where you live. So, I mean, it ties into this because obviously if you're in LA, I did assume you lived in LA because a lot of this film, it feels like you have seen firsthand some of these monstrous creations that you've put on screen up close, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, no comment. But no, it's never anybody particularly, but we had, 1,000 run-ins with people with that kind of corporate doublespeak bullshit of, well, let's keep talking. And it's exciting. We're all excited. This is great. Let's keep talking. Let's circle back. All of that kind of bullshit we wanted to include in the film. And that was just kind of this mantra that we heard in Hollywood of let's keep talking, let's not do anything. Let's just keep talking about doing the thing. And we realized like all of the hustle that happens in Hollywood with that, where like you can be brought on as a screenwriter to write something. And if the development team is just talking about doing the thing, they're getting paid to develop the thing and you're not making anything. So the longer that they can continue to talk about making movies and not doing them and getting bad reviews, the better and the more money that they'll make, the better they'll feel, the more money they make. So it's a strange hustle in Hollywood where everybody's talking and not actually doing anything. And so we wanted to kind of make fun of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's that age old adage, isn't it? You know, it's called show business for a reason.
Yeah. It's a very strange thing where like the technology is there now. You and I can be talking across the world and making audio and video together. And it's never been easier to make movies. And in the history of film, it's only going to get easier to make content in your garage if you want to. And nobody's acting like that. Everybody still feels like they have to spend years and years and years talking about doing something before they can go and do it. And I think it's terrible. It's up to independent filmmakers to bottom out the system. And I think that we're seeing it happen.
Well, let's talk about that. And let's talk about you, because before we get into the beta test, I did want to sort of touch on your debut feature, Thunder Road. I mean, I know it's not your debut feature. There was a feature a very long time ago, 2010, 2011. But like your first feature.
Oh, you've done your research. Okay, well.
Your first feature. Yeah.
I count that as my first feature. I call No Flood Wall Here my zero feature. And then I also made a series of six short films that then we re-edited to make it into a feature called Minutes. So technically Thunder Road's a bit of my third, but it was the first time that it was any good. So I call that my first feature.
So 2018, it comes out and it has this wonderful reception. Among other prizes, it won the Grand Jury Prize at South by Southwest. How did that change things for you? Can you quantify whether that did actually change things for you?
The only thing so the biggest change for me was making the short film with my friends in 6 hours in a funeral home in late 2015, and then the short film winning Sundance 2016. Mm. And that was a real catalyst to people taking us seriously, but it never converted it into anybody giving us money or giving us the financing that we would need to make even a small budget feature. So I had to do the Thunder Road feature by running a Kickstarter campaign and then bringing in private equity from strangers on the internet that wanted to help it out because they saw the short film and appreciated it. So it didn't really qualify us in the eyes of Hollywood, and it still didn't when we won South by Southwest. But it did qualify us in the eyes of the public and people that were interested in helping us out in a fan base, which is insane that we were able to do that. So even after winning South by Southwest and getting into Cannes with the Thunder Road feature, the highest offer that we got from a distributor was still half of the budget of the movie. And wow. The budget of the movie is 190 grand. So like we were going to be selling the product. We were selling this feature film that's doing very well around the world for half of the budget that it cost to make it. And we just thought, well, no, we're not going to do that. And so we self-distributed it and made the entire budget back of the feature in the first 2 weeks of being in French cinemas alone. Like it's such an ugly predatory landscape for independent film. And we kind of stumbled into it in the time when you could completely circumvent it through using iTunes aggregators or calling movie theaters yourself and impersonating a distribution company and saying, hey, would you like to play our movie? And most people had heard of the movie by that time and said, yeah, oh yeah, we want that one.
So is that because Thunder Road fell, its release fell sort of 2018, you know, which I don't know that it's changed so much since then, really. That the landscape of cinema is very much, you know, we want franchises, event movies. If you want a theatrical movie, it needs to be part of an existing IP. It needs to be something that, you know, is going to bring in, you know, hundreds of millions, because those are the movies that are being released theatrically. And I know that's not entirely true, because you do have the smaller movies, but they tend to be like genre films, like a horror, for example. There's a huge wealth of horror that costs under 10 million.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And my first feature that I was a producer on was a film called 13 Cameras. And we shot it in 10 days in a backyard for 35 grand American for nothing. And it's grossed $1 million so far. So like there is a lot of gold in them hills of doing a genre film. But I hate to say it, like I'm going to plant a flag there and say that I disagree, where the movies that are coming out in cinemas are all franchises and sequels and reboots and all that stuff. But people are sick of those because they're made for the broadest possible audience, which means they can't curse, they can't show sex, they can't show violence. And some of these movies are like trying to show that they're trying to say that they're big, cool movies for adults, and they're actually made for children. And so there's this huge chasm in the marketplace where if you can show real cursing and real sex and real violence, all the stuff that these pervert audiences, you know, my audience wants to watch, you can fill that void and you can show people what they can't see on TV. And that is how rock and roll came about. That is how any of these giant movements of, you know, populist movements and artwork came about, to get people to actually laugh instead of kind of chuckle along throughout a movie. I think really we are now at this incredible cusp where movies like Minari or Parasite are getting nominated for these big awards, and they're made in living rooms in countries all over the world. It's not the big franchise things. It's not even the big like dramas that are coming out around the world that are doing well, because audiences are kind of sick of it.
So even if it didn't, even if Thunder Road didn't change the way the industry viewed you as a filmmaker, did it change things for you personally? Did it perhaps silence any doubts you have, or give you a validation that you realized that, wow, like there is an audience out there for the work I'm making?
Sure. And also, and not just that, it was a complete confidence change in me, where I've had all these like fears and feelings of inadequacy that was kind of imposed on me by just being an independent filmmaker for 10 years and struggling. And like, it is such a lonely experience making movies and having these daydreams and then not being able to make them any good. And it took me doing this short film and really caring about it to understand how I spoke the language of film. It was like learning a new language of like how you do it. And then finally becoming pretty fluent at it was incredibly fulfilling and a confidence boost for me. But then beyond that, really seeing the test that we were doing of fusing comedy and heartbreak or comedy and horror, and that was working, was really wonderful to sit in a movie theater and watch these movies and have people gasp and laugh within a minute, or cry and laugh within a minute. I was like, cool, this genre fluid stuff is stuff that we can do really well as independents that Hollywood can't do. It's very difficult to do it. And we've been very, very lucky. So yeah, all of that kind of became this acceleration towards, well, let's just keep doing it. Let's just see how far we can push it. Let's see what kind of cool stuff we can do. And then we raised the funds for the beta test through the internet. Like, it was never through a Hollywood system. We never would have gotten this film made in Hollywood because it's so radioactive, I guess.
I can believe that. I think that of all your films, this would be the
toughest. It's the biggest fuck you to Hollywood. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I think really we're not turning back. Like, the fact that we can make movies and finance them from a laptop and then edit them from a garage and a laptop, we feel like hackers. It feels like we've cheated the system in this funny way, or completely circumvented the system in this funny way, and still are able to play on the world stage, you know, in competition with some of these movies that cost way too much money that suck.
It's amazing. I mean, from my end, you're absolutely right. And to watch the beta test, it's just such an exciting experience because it is, you know, unique and original. I don't feel like they quite sort of encapsulate what I'm trying to say, but there is an energy to the writing. There's something unexpected around every corner. There's an energy to your performance that just feels so new. And
okay, cool.
And it should, I guess it shouldn't. There should be more films like this. There should be more films that you sit down and watch and are just so surprised by. And it's sort of like it blindsides you because you are kind of accustomed to a certain way of film language, a certain film language these days.
Yeah, it's funny. We're like, those are my favorite kinds of movies, when you're watching Zodiac or Corpus Christi or Parasite, and you're like, what the hell is going on? Right. You kind of you're forced to play detective. And so long as it's still funny, so long as you can still laugh at the characters, that carries your attention level throughout the film. And then, you know, there's scares and murder scenes throughout the movie as well. It is this kind of goofy Chinatown detective story, as well as being this erotic thriller. Yeah, there's like 10 movies in this one movie. And I think we might have like overstretched ourselves, but to watch it, it is like methamphetamine or something. You're watching, it's like, oh my God, like, it's just constant barrage of things that are happening in the film.
And like, you know, I mean, I've seen it happen firsthand. You know, I've sat with people who have been on their phones while watching cinema.
Yeah, bro.
And I genuinely think it is possible.
Studio
to do that.
Executives, man. I came out with Thunder Road, and we would bring the DCP to a studio and watch it with people, and it would just be glowing faces in the audience because they're on their phones doing this thing. They don't give a shit. They don't watch movies. They don't like movies. It's a weird thing. And like, they know that the filmmaker's in the crowd and that they're probably watching them. It's like, it is just this complete facade of, oh, I'm excited. Yeah, your movie's great. Oh, I loved it. Loved it so much. And they weren't even in the room. They didn't even watch the movie. It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I guess to go back to, you know, the beta test, it's a film that you can't watch like while you're on your phone, though. Like, I do think there are certain movies these days that oh God, I heard this terrifying thing that I can't remember which streamer it was. One of the streamers was looking for a way of having scripts written that were designed to be watched by people who would be on their phone at the same time as watching a movie. So you'd have to repeat parts of the script because it would make it like they're so aware that people sitting at home are on their phones that they're designing television programs for that. And so to watch something like the beta test, it's like you can't, you look away for like 5 minutes and you're missing like some like a wonderful intricacy.
Isn't that so funny that they're trying to change the narrative storytelling stuff instead of just making better movies? That it's just like, oh no, we have to adapt to, we have to build the road for the walker rather than change the walker's interest in the road. Yeah, it's stupid.
So I remember Thunder Road coming out over here, obviously. It found a UK audience. I wonder how much you love that, because I know you're a huge fan of UK comedy.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it was a dream. I mean, I grew up watching The Young Ones and Alan Partridge. And so like all, and you know, a bit of Fry and Laurie and Jeeves and Wooster. So much of my childhood is based around English comedy. And it's crazy that like Steve is now a pen pal, Coogan's a pen pal of mine now. And so it's like, I actually get to, if you make something impressive that is in the tradition of these styles, the people who are your heroes will reach out and be like, hey, I saw that thing. You copied Alan in this one moment. And I'm like, oh, fuck, you copy. Man, it's been really great.
He's been in touch he's been in touch and gone, I think you stole from me, but I still loved it.
It was really funny. He was like, I was like, oh, if you think that's all I've stolen from you, you're very, it's very underwhelming. I hung out with him for almost 4 hours the first time we hung out, and it was like uninterrupted eye contact, just talking about the craft. And we're sitting right next to each other at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills. And there were so many things that we did where it was like, how do you do it? Okay, now how do I do it? And it's kind of like talking about forensic comedy, and every small thing has to be planned. Every mannerism has to be planned. And in America, that's not the case. America is so based in improv comedy that it's like, we'll just set up 8 cameras and do some over the shoulders and then we'll fix it in the edit. And it's just, you know, get these improv comics to come in and do the thing. And that's, I always hated that. I was really bad at that stuff. And I had to rehearse 1,000 times for it to be any good. And talking to Steve, he was like, when he was coming up, and there was comedy troupes, they were always making fun of him for doing radio. I was like, oh yeah, you're doing these like radio commercials. You should really be into acting. And that created this vitriol in him to be like, I'm going to fucking bury these guys in the ground. I'm going to be the best comic in the world. I'm going to create the best character in human history. And he has.
He's going to be a small time radio DJ as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to play this pathetic small town conservative radio guy. But really, I had those almost exact same enemies, these people that I despised in comedy, who I thought were phoning it in and just doing cheap, stupid stuff. And that became ambition in me. So it's been really wonderful to kind of have like shared history in that sense, the same axe to grind. It's very important if you are trying to become successful to have those people that you want to beat up.
I know. I get it. You know, it is. It's like, you know, whatever feeds the beast, let's say, inside you, that kind of dissatisfaction is one thing. But then you need sort of to be like angry isn't the word, but more determined because
petty.
Of it.
Yeah, that is the word.
Yeah, let's call it what it is. Yeah, it's been
helpful to me. Like really, to get off of the couch, I was a producer for many years, and I would go to film festivals and see these blocks of short films that one of my buddy's shorts was playing in. And to watch 8 great shorts from around the world, I'd be like, oh my God, that's so cool. People are doing cool stuff in Poland. That's really cool. But it really took the 3 shorts in the block that kind of sucked for me to go, oh, I could do, all I have to do is be better than those shorts. Okay, I see. Then I could do well. And it really was that seeing things get celebrated for their mediocrity was the thing that actually got me up to make stuff. It's petty and awful about the human mind and male ambition, but that was the thing that got me off the couch.
I mean, it's fine. I think it's only when you don't realize that and sort of don't know it that it becomes problematic. As long as you can go, yeah, look, I'm aware of this flaw in myself that's driven me. You like Ricky Gervais as well, though. The reason I bring this up is because You downloaded all these old XFM shows, huh?
Wow, you did your research. Oh my God, yeah. And I downloaded them before they were ever available on Spotify. This was like, you know, 2006 or something, when it was actually just after they came out.
Yeah. So the only reason I bring that up is I did the show before him on that radio station. So I basically,
you're kidding me.
I did the Ricky Gervais warm-up show just before him and Stephen Cole came on. So I did 10 till 1 on a Saturday morning. They did 1 till 3. So I used to listen to that show because most DJs would be straight out the door and I'd sit in the office listening.
So when they say, hey, thanks, guys, so much, and then they start their show, who's talking about you?
Wow. Yep.
That was me. That was me on my way out the door to stick the radio on in the office and listen to it because it was brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. That's so funny, man. Small world.
And now here's a weird one because we're going to get into the beta test now. And I don't know whether your character Jordan, I felt there was a little bit of John Cleese energy about him. This wasn't while I was watching, but afterwards I was like, shit, there's that whole sort of Fawlty Towers, Basil Fawlty thing where it's a man constantly desperate to stay in control as the world around him will not let him to.
Sure. I actually haven't thought of that. But in looking back, there's moments of me like doing these goofy mannerisms that are like John Cleese's height and like using the body comedy to humiliate myself. Yeah, that makes sense.
So how's this for a description then? This is what I've got written down here. I did have to write it down. I am going to have to read this. So how's this for a description of the beta test? An erotic thriller, black comedy, horror satire on the entertainment industry.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm going to steal that. We've been looking for a synopsis because it's difficult. I mean, like people will say like, what genre would this be? And I'm always like, whatever Parasite is, I don't know. Like whatever, like it's just, it's like a comedy, horror, drama, poignant thing. I don't know. Like, I don't know. It's genre fluid. I have no idea. But yeah, I'm much less eloquent than what you've just spouted.
I like genre fluid. I've not heard that term before. Genre fluid. That's great. Is that a term? Is that a thing? Is that yours or is that out there?
I've stolen that from gender fluidity. And now I'm like, all right, cool. We could be genre fluid as well. Cool. And I realized like I've been trying to coin a term about what our movies are. And I think genre fluid is kind of the best one.
Fucking great. It's really good. It's really good. So in a nutshell, and I do mean like it's a big nutshell, but it's a nutshell. It's about a Hollywood agent who begins to question who the fuck he is and what it all means and can no longer keep up the fake identity he's built himself.
See, I'm so glad to hear you say that because some people do the reductionist thing of calling him a sociopath and relating it to American Psycho, but it is just a facade. It's just this kind of weird business thing. I don't think he's a sociopath. He's just this very confused, horny idiot, you know? And so I think because of that, he's a bit more likable. The allegiance of the audience loves watching him fail and they want to see him learn his lesson, but he's not a monster, I don't think. So I think that's true.
No, I think it's a testament to your performance that at no point, despite everything that Jordan is in this film, you do sympathize with him. Like you do feel sorry for him.
Yeah, it's funny that like all it takes is him when someone says, here, have a drink. We're all having fun. He goes, no, 5 years sober. But I'm wondering, like immediately the audience is like, oh, it's, okay. Like it's funny that you can have somebody be an absolute monster. And if you have them save a cat from a tree in one scene, they're like, wow, he's got a heart of gold.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's the famous save the cat, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's the whole thing. But it started life. And we'll get onto the backdrop in a moment, but it really started life as more of a thriller based on an idea that yourself and PJ McCabe, your writing partner and directing partner on this, came up with.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Which was about a guy just receiving this purple envelope, which offered him a no strings attached sexual encounter. And that was, there they are.
All the purple envelopes. Sorry. Yeah. I have 1,000 purple envelopes in my apartment. Sorry.
Yeah. So where did that idea come from? That the actual genesis of what this film grew into?
Yeah, so I had a meeting with some friends, and it was a husband and wife and a couple other people. And I'm I have a significant other, my girlfriend Julia, and we're kind of like hanging out. And then we all got up to leave, and it kind of became this moment of saying goodbye. And I'm half through the hug of hugging this girl. And then I started to back away, and there was kind of somebody else was talking. But as I kind of backed out of the hug, distracted with something else, she just kept her hand on my back for a few seconds too long. And there was no doubt in my mind that it was an invitation, because it was private and nobody else could see it. But it was kind of this thing of us being close to each other that was like, I see, that is a forceful hand on the back. And it was this small thing. And I was like, that's really weird. That's really uncomfortable. And I don't know how to handle this thing. And then I thought, like, well, what if I got a letter? What if somebody got a letter that invited you to a no strings attached sexual encounter with an admirer, not a stranger? It's not Tinder. It's like someone has designed this analog thing to come into your mailbox and possibly completely derail your life. And I was like, that is such a crazy Twilight Zone episode. I don't know what I would do. And I called PJ, and I was in the grocery store. I was kind of like hiding. I was like talking to PJ in the grocery store, and he was in a grocery store with his mom. And I said, what would you do if you got this letter? And he goes, oh man, hold on. And he like walks outside. And we had this like hour and a half long conversation about, he was like, no, I wouldn't go because I'd get murdered. That's an insane thing. And then he was like, let's keep developing this thing. This is a neat, you know, a genesis for a movie. And then because the movie is about lying and cheating, of course, we had to set it at a talent agency. And so we like did all this research about the biggest liars and cheaters in the world. And we kind of formed this narrative about data scraping, how you would actually connect people from their search histories and public, you know, social profiles and digital footprints and stuff like that. And PJ did all this research about big data, and we kind of worked that into the film as well. But it was fusing because so much of the agency world is based around connecting people. And it used to be a social network, agencies. It used to be something to connect creatives together and to kind of separate the public from celebrities. It was kind of these like glorified call centers and mailrooms set up in the 1920s and 30s. And now that we have real social networks, those platforms and societies that were agencies are kind of going away. They're having much and much less utility. And so that became very interesting to us, that it was about connecting people and also about agents connecting people and showing this all through one person's stress in a collapsing industry. It just worked. And we're like, all right, cool. Now we have to run at this thing as hard as possible and humiliate these fuckers. It was really, really fun.
So was it fun for you because you exist outside that world as well? Because I mean, in the sense that as an independent filmmaker, you know, you could literally like go really go for them without any fear of repercussions.
I mean, what are they going to do? Like, honestly, like, that's the thing. It's a comedy. It's like a South Park episode. And if you're going to take offense to something like that, like, you're not cool. Like, you take the fucking joke. And that's a good sign of the fury, the scary, like, power dynamics that are set up, that, like, you can't even make jokes about these things because you'll be canceled. You'll be blacklisted from the system. But we've never had any help. Like, 99% of the work that I get comes from Vimeo. It comes from, like, people reaching out and saying, hey, I saw your things. Could you, like, you know, or like IMDb Pro. Like, it's usually never the Hollywood system. It's directors who like my stuff who call me to act in a movie of theirs. So yeah, then with this one, we got the financing from the internet, completely circumventing the system and the way that you would do it normally. And then we were able to produce it by ourselves at our production offices, in our homes and apartments and offices, to make it look like it's a Hollywood agency. And then, you know, we played it on the world stage at Berlinale and Tribeca and kind of all over, which is insane. There's no difference from how we make movies and how, you know, Tom Cruise makes movies. It's just smaller amounts of private financing.
It is amazing, this whole backdrop that you've set it against. Because I was reading about it at the time, the idea that the agencies, and like you say, it was because they were losing their power. Like, you know, they, because of social media, because their clients could now, you know, build relationships, industry relationships, without having to go through their agent. They were like this huge sort of injured, flailing giant looking for control, getting the control back. So they, as I understand it, they were basically wanting to set up, they wanted to be, say, they were creatives themselves. Yeah, they wanted to have a studio. Because, yeah. I mean, the insane thing is, like, first of all, it was terrifying if you worked in the industry and you weren't going to be part of one of these mega agencies. But then the idea that they were lowballing, like, their own talent, because rather than making money for the talent, they were then going, well, actually, if we pay this writer less, then we're making more money as their agent.
Yep. Talk about a conflict of interest, that somebody who's desperate, who is a creative, who's very talented, comes to these people hoping that they will support them. And instead, they are their bosses in a weird way. It's a complete shift in the power dynamics of how it should be. And no industry functions like that. Like, and these fucking war criminals were trying to change the structures of Hollywood to exclusively benefit them. In the film, there's a moment when I say, they're not going to let us take all the money. Why do we think they're going to let us take all the money? PJ explained it to me. We're becoming travel agents. And it's so poignant. It's like the most honest this guy is about this fight that was happening in Hollywood at the time to prevent the Death Star from winning. You know, it's like, it was a real rebel alliance that was the Writers Guild of America putting up this fight they didn't have to put up and say, no, you can't become the studio system. You guys are criminals. We should not let the bad guys be in charge. And they won. It's unbelievable that this happened and nobody's talking about it.
Mm. It's strange. I tried to understand whether there was a similarity to what was going on here in the UK. Because, I mean, the weird thing is, like, obviously, I think most of these agencies, I'm pretty sure WME, CAA, they have arms in the UK. But what we don't have is a Writers Guild, I don't think, as an equivalent. So, and yet it is still, I guess, like the best movies, like, it's a very easy concept to understand, you know, like The Social Network. You know, you suddenly understand coding, Moneyball. You're like, I get baseball, and you can enjoy the film without actually knowing all of the intricacies of what's being talked about.
Yeah, I find that to be very interesting. Like the spoonful of sugar thing of making a comedy, but it's also about something very important. Social Network is one of my favorites. The Big Short is one of my favorites. It's like to be able to have it be comedically driven while also being this fast-paced detective story kind of what a big system is like, where it's also very well researched. We had 11 assistants, agents, ex-agents, and ex-assistants break their NDAs to give us testimony and emails and document dumps so that it kind of like added up to what was all of the research in the film that took us a year and a half to do, to gather. And just like the vernacular of how these people speak, we wanted to get it right, because if you're going to be making fun of something, it can't be somebody saying, oh, that's not how we're like at all. And so it was very worth it to do that. And we were kind of copying Adam McKay's style for these moments, because we knew that was going to work.
It is, it's, It's fascinating because, I mean, to have actually got all this firsthand information, I mean, because even imagine if no one had responded to that request that I think you put out on Twitter, wasn't it? It was Twitter, yeah. You were like, has anyone got any, this is what we're doing. It's amazing that people responded, to be perfectly honest, because, you know, I imagine a lot of those assistants do live in a state of fear about their jobs. So I guess maybe it was a release for them?
Yeah. I mean, really, it's like some people were too scared to do it, but then their roommate spoke to us or their ex-girlfriends spoke to us. Mm. So like we had people, some of the more telling stuff about the relationship of Jordan and Caroline in the film was about being with a liar, being with someone whose job is lying. And then they come home and tell you how much they lied that day and how it affects the human relationship of being a partner with someone, how your partner sees you. It changes because of the corrosiveness of your job decisions. And we just found that so interesting. So like legitimately, I tweeted once being like, hey, does anybody have anybody in the agency world? I'm trying to do some research, asking for a friend, basically. And then I had to delete it because we got so much outreach and it was like, oh no, people are gonna find out about it. But I got several DMs on many different platforms, LinkedIn, not just Twitter, being like, hey, I know somebody, my roommate, or like this kind of thing. And so we were able to kind of have these coffee meetings and these phone calls, and sometimes they would just send us stuff of like, this is someone's mailbox. This is kind of what it's like. And then they were also driving us to like the Sony hacks of like these specific email chains to the WGA and people trying to screw over the creatives and how the sausage is made in the industry. It was very interesting. It was a weird time to research it, but everybody was so open. And it was a bit like when we would go to the next meeting, we would tell people, you know, testimony that we'd heard from the previous meeting. And then they would say, oh, that's nothing. That's great. And they were kept on trying to like be more impressive than the previous source that we had. And so it was very easy. You know, it was like, I'm sure Bob Woodward makes it seem like it's a hard job, but if someone comes out of the White House and is like, oh, you had heard from this guy. Oh, well, I got all the juice. You don't even know.
Yeah. It's, because obviously like, you're fascinated. I'm assuming you're fascinated. I don't want to put words in your mouth by the male ego and this idea of men just like toxic masculinity. I mean, God, it was only April, was it, this year when it was, you know, it all came out. The Hollywood Reporter did that big piece about Scott Rudin. And all of that, you know,
slammed a computer on his employees' hands. And mm-hmm. also, some of that stuff is commonplace. I hate to say, like, I mean, obviously the physical violence and having to go to the hospital or urgent care is like kind of rare. And I'm glad that story came out. And then also like a lot of the team from The Social Network was like, yeah, that's bound to happen. I've known Scott for 20 years. I was terrified of him. Anytime he would come into the office, people would jump. And it's funny, but it's also awful. We heard testimony from someone at one of the top four agencies. And they said that they weren't allowed to be in the bullpens, which I guess they were like, it's worse. And they're like, oh, you're new here. You should come and work in the front. And they were sitting in the front doing reception. And in the first week, the source said, even though I wasn't in the bullpen, it didn't stop me from seeing a fist fight in the office where these two macho guys in suits were slamming each other up against the glass doors of the front with the like logo of the agency. And the source said, not only did I see it with my own eyes, I watched it on the security camera footage later when everybody's like, oh yeah, this is crazy. There's a high drama happened in the office. And the source said, the crazy thing wasn't that it happened. That kind of stuff we saw roughhousing all the time. It's a culture run almost exclusively by men. But the source said, the crazy thing was that nobody got their cell phone out. Nobody filmed it. And then nobody filmed the security camera footage afterwards. It was like this culture of silence of, oh yeah, we know how bad and toxic the workplace is, but we could never tell anybody that. It's like North Korea or something like that. It's this strange psychosis that as soon as you enter the building, you are a subordinate to this system because we all watched Entourage at the fraternity house and we know how this power dynamic works. It's a culture of fear and it's awful and I hope it dies.
And I guess also, you know, at the point when things like this were happening, simultaneously, you know, if you go back, probably about 10 years, and these characteristics weren't like held up as like, this is appalling behavior. They were almost celebrated. It was this idea that, yeah, but he's the most feared producer in Hollywood. And it was like a badge of honor to be this scary man who did horrible things. And, you know, it's only, so, you know, if you work there, but the press is going, you know, for example, you know, this guy is, you know, he's a legend for just getting shit done. Then you're not going to come forward. You're not going to say anything.
Yeah, it's really bad to see. I think it was the Oscars. It was some award ceremony where Harvey was there and Seth MacFarlane got up and made a joke about, like, I forget what the joke actually was and I'll butcher it, but he acknowledged that to make it in Hollywood, you'd have to sleep with Harvey Weinstein. And the whole audience laughs. And he has this kind of like smarmy, cutesy smile, like, hey, I'm making these insider jokes. And it's a horrifying documentary in retrospect. It's this kind of like origin story of a super villain. And that kind of blind eye cutesy stuff against women is so scary to look back on. And it just shows how pervasive it is and still is. Like, this Harvey's in prison, but the system that supported this guy, all of his assistants, all of his co-producers on the thousands of movies that he's worked on, all knew that this was happening. If you work with somebody for 10 years, you know how they eat. You know how many times they sneeze when they start sneezing. Like, you know everything about these people, and those people aren't in prison. Those people are still having very successful careers in the film industry. I've met some of them, and they act as though, oh yeah, no, everything's great. Don't worry about it. They do the fucking Jordan Hines thing, and it's scary, man. It's like, and I'm glad that I came into this when, you know, I'm young enough to be able to see the problems for what they are and understand the power structures, and that comedy can sometimes be a cleanser of this thing. And if you can make fun of these people, they lose their power. But yeah, it is a dangerous and toxic work environment, particularly for women. And I think it's changing, but it's still the same people in power.
Mm. I mean, like you say, some of the humor, dark humor, brilliant humor in this is being able, like, through your character Jordan, to basically illustrate this. I mean, so what's the line when you're talking to your assistant, Jacqueline, where you're like, I can't say what I want to say to you right now because of the direction
the agency and the country is going. And yeah. it's this fucking Joe Rogan line coming out of this guy, just like, oh my God, like, of course he's a conservative or whatever. Yeah, it's like, that kind of powerless teeth removal of the male ego is just so funny to watch. And it's great to watch it with an audience because everybody laughs out loud at that moment of like, oh, he just couldn't wait to say this. You know, it's like, has nothing to do with what's happening in the scene, but because he couldn't call her the B word in the office anymore, he's frustrated. It's great.
And then of course you were just talking about him, but there is that incredible line in that incredible monologue, in that incredible scene that you deliver at the end in the car park, where you're like, nobody knows what's going on and everybody still wants to be Harvey, which is, it's a really, it sent shivers down my spine when I heard it.
It's true. And also that stuff of like, everybody's wearing suits and kind of on standby because the emperor was beheaded. And it's like, oh, well, what do we do now? I guess, can I still look up to this person? It's like when a cult leader, gets put in prison or something, and it becomes this complete shock to the system where everybody's having to reanalyze who their role models are and what a role model in the film industry should be. It's wonderful to see Mount Rushmore get blown up and then to not know where you stand. And I love that line. It's two of my favorite lines in the film because that's how it feels right now in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say too much about this scene because it happens at the end. So I'll just call it the diner scene. But there's some lovely dialogue which really sort of helps sort of resolve some of the questions that the film throws up in a really interesting way.
We can talk about it.
I don't know. I don't want to spoil it because it's such a great film and it's such a great moment. And I don't think you watch this knowing what happens to Jordan. I certainly wasn't sure how it was going to end. So I'm just being very, very careful because people may well watch this listen to this before the film.
So then let's talk about the film that we stole it from. So it's from No Country for Old Men. And at the end of No Country for Old Men, he's talking to his brother and he says, look, what you're dealing with ain't nothing new. This country's hard on people. And then he says, country's changing and it's not waiting on you. That's vanity. And it's this like beautiful monologue. And we kind of steal stuff from that for this moment where my main character's fiance, wife at the time, can kind of make this concise description of what everything was of the film and, you know, this nice little wrapped up bow at the end of the film.
And a massive release for the audience. And for me, it's sort of like the calm after the storm. It's sort of like,
okay, good.
Oh, okay. Things are going to be all right. You just need to like stop stressing about all this shit and just go.
Be honest. Be honest with your partner and be honest with yourself. And don't lie all the time. It's a very important message.
And if all that sounds too serious for anyone listening, like fucking hell, what's this movie? I mean, there are just
comedy.
It is a comedy. There's one line as well. I mean, we touched on it earlier about agents, you know, deciding that they were suddenly creatives. Why not? We can do it. Other people do it. So we're going to be creatives. And it's that line now. Sorry. We've just signed Tiger Woods as director. They're going to reboot Caddyshack with dogs. Sorry. It's such a funny line. It sort of encapsulates everything in one line, the insanity of it all.
It's a stupid, stupid industry. It's a lot of bullshit. It's important to not step in it for too long and keep it out of your mouths.
But I do love it. I do love it. So we touched on this earlier. Do you think as a result of the Writers Guild's win over the agents, do you think the structure has been altered in Hollywood and there's going to be maybe a positive change to the way studio films are made? And does that even interest you, or are you just happy doing what you're doing?
IATSE is going to strike right now. I mean, like our union of basically the infrastructure of making movies, every single human being that works on film sets is repped by a union called IATSE, and they're potentially going on strike because they've been working over 14-hour days, sometimes 6 days a week, 7 days a week, for overtime and getting paid nothing. And it's such an unhealthy work environment for people. It's killing them. Mm. And only now, post-pandemic and during the pandemic, do they say, well, what do I want in life? I mean, I don't want this. I don't want to be a workhorse until I'm 70 and my knees give out. That's not a life. I'm away from my family. I'm sacrificing my body and my mind to this thing to make a shitty TV show for somebody. And it's going to end after 3 episodes because, you know, who cares? I think the power is becoming now more with the people, where people in America are sick and tired of taking it and they can support a strike when it happens now, because we all feel that, you know, we all get to a point of breaking over the last year. And I think supporting the workers is a very important thing. So I think really the industry is changing because people could say, yeah, actually, no, thanks. I'm not going to do that job. I'm actually going to walk off. I'm actually just going to be over here. And if you want to talk to my union rep, you can do that. I think that's the only power we have sometimes is collaborative bargaining.
And as a creative yourself, you know, would you ever consider working within the studio system? I guess I ask because, you know, there I don't know, to pick a name out of a hat, there are people who have started in shorts and then worked on independent features, like Cary Fukunaga, who I saw Bond the other day. And you know, obviously now he's directing Bond. You know, does that offer an appeal to you?
If the movie's gonna be dope, I mean, yeah, I'd love to do Bond. If they want Bond to be an American next time, I'm right here. Nobody's gonna ask me. But no, seriously, like looking at Destin Daniel Cretton, who made a Short Term 12, and then now is doing big Marvel movies. Like, I think that's and if he has free reign to be able to make cool, you know, Jackie Chan, you know, fight scenes and stuff, I'm so down for that. I love watching that movie. I'd love to do that, but nobody's asking me. And also, I'm really enjoying making stuff on my own. It's been nice to not pull punches. I think what's going to happen once this movie comes out is it's going to be this great litmus test where if somebody does reach out, they already know that I've research the bullshit. And like, I think that the cool people are going to go, yeah, let's work with these people. They get it. Yeah. And I think people have been complaining about this stuff for the last 10 years that it actually might help us in Hollywood, even though we've made fun of so many of the people that work there. I think it might be a great separation of the wheat from the chaff to find cool people that might support us.
Yeah, because I don't think you can ever underestimate like awareness being a very valuable thing, and people going, wow, they're aware. You know, it's that it's self-aware and awareness of everything. And
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I read a really nice review and which compared to your performance, and I hope you don't mind me quoting a review because you might be someone who stays away from reviews.
No, it's okay.
Okay, cool. They compared your performance to the very best of Jim Carrey. And I wondered how you felt about that, because I'm a Carrey fan, and I think the examples they used were things like Eternal Sunshine, Man in the Moon, when he sort of went off and started sort of, he left behind the mania.
Yeah, there's one moment in the parking garage monologue, mea culpa, at the end of the film, where I do this mannerism that I think I accidentally stole from Liar Liar, but he says, and I didn't look at the place card settings email. And it's like this very specific Jim Carrey 1990s mannerism. And I think so many people, when watching the movie, see that mannerism and go, oh, Jim Carrey. And it's like, it stresses me out, where I'm like, you know, I was dancing between like the line of Jason Bateman of just like, hey, how are you? No, see that, what's wonderful about that. And then I'm like, no, that's Jason Bateman. I can't do that. And then we have to go back and reshoot that moment. There's all of the, or Will Ferrell, you can't scream in a parking lot at someone with ridiculous lines without people going, oh, that's Will Ferrell. I love Jim Carrey, and I met his team, and he's just this really calm, quiet, like eccentric painter in his office. And I think, you know, he became very famous at a very young age and is now doing only the stuff that he cares about. And I think that's respectable. I really like that guy. I think he's a very, very talented man, and he has such a rubber face, and it's very much like mine, where all it takes is me raising my eyebrows or lowering them a little bit, and the audience is like, oh, I know what he's thinking. And so I feel a lot of camaraderie with that dude.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you touched on the theme there. It's sort of what you equate happiness to. Like, is happiness success? Is happiness, you know, making the biggest movie in the world one year, but having very little actual control over what the finished product is on screen? Or is happiness, you know, making a film that not as many people are going to see, but it's all yours and you can stand by it and go, that is entirely mine?
Happiness for me is, yeah, exactly that. Making something, writing your own jokes, and then performing them on a stage or on the screen and having an audience laugh and go, cool, I knew that was going to work. It is predicting where the audience is going to be on the roller coaster and then getting the fruits of your labor. Like, to have spent all of this time researching and working my ass off and rehearsing and doing the craft that is making a movie, and then editing it in a small garage in my boxers at times in the heat, and then screening it on the world stage and hearing uproarious laughter, that is happiness to me.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. And the one thing we haven't really talked about in the film, you touched on it, is this data farming thing that is so scary, that you read about in the news on an almost daily basis, and the fact that all our data is being collected and collated and used against us by any number of companies. And PJ's character, PJ, actually, you know, sort of talks us through that. And it's one of those scenes that you do watch and you immediately go, why the fuck am I on social media? I should delete everything now. And then you just never do, because you're like, oh, but I might need it for something.
Yeah, people I might get invited to a party, and they're like, oh, he's not on Facebook. I'm not going to invite this guy to the party. Yeah, that FOMO, that fear of missing out, it's real. And yeah, that's so topical. Last 2 days, a whistleblower came out and said, Facebook knows what they're doing to young women. It's terrible, and they're not doing anything about it. They won't, unless Congress acts to dial these people in, to hamstring them. It's necessary. And then Facebook goes down for 24 hours, which is very suspicious while that's happening. Who knows? But yeah, it's a real thing. And there are good social media platforms, and there are some pretty serious criminals out there that are selling information to sway elections. And it's nice to be invited to parties, but it's not worth it if the bad guys end up winning the presidency.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, you and I mean, everyone needs it when you work in an industry, purely because, not just because people go, oh, I guess they're not working anymore. If you're not on Facebook or whatever, or, you know, you're not tweeting on a regular basis, but it is about being contactable. And, you know, like how we started this conversation, sort of being able to exist outside a sort of old archaic system does require you to sort of be easy to contact. So you do kind of need to be on it.
Yeah. I mean, there's another thing of like people can find you if they want to. If they need to get your contact information, they can get in touch with you, even if you're very obscure. Like we've been able to track down people, like we say it in the film, but we've contacted people on Venmo. Like we found, you know, celebrities or people that we wanted to talk to in films, and we would request 2 cents from them to get their 2 cents on a script to be like, hey, would you be interested in working on this movie? And we've gotten coffee meetings out of it. It's insane that like that worked somehow. It made them laugh and they're like, all right, cool, you guys got me. So yeah, I don't know. Like there are, it's a dangerous thing. And if there are bad actors who are going to be doing it, it can completely derail someone's life in a very frightening way. It feels like a horror movie or a Twilight Zone episode. But no, I think really as a small businessman making little movies, it's been incredibly utilitarian to be able to have stuff on Twitter or on Instagram, and some celebrity can reach out and say, hey, I saw you on an airplane in this movie. Would you want to come and act in this new big one? And I go, oh, this is great. Like nobody would have asked me otherwise. It's very important to have these channels to be connected to people. And then sometimes it can be really corruptive.
Yeah. So listen, you're coming over to the UK for the UK premiere, 15th of October. It's out here. Great time to be back in the theatre, in the cinemas, showing a movie in the cinemas, huh? Have you missed it? Have you been back since they reopened? Are they open there?
Yeah, they're open here. And I got to go to France and watch the beta test for the first time in a cinema with a crowd, which was amazing. And then I came back to Texas to Fantastic Fest and watched it there. Edgar Wright was there the week before. I just missed him.
Oh, man.
Which sucks. But he's a pen pal. He's a good buddy. Him and Simon Pegg, which is crazy. Actually, Simon just emailed me this morning and saw the beta test last night and was like, oh my God, this movie is so good. Yeah, he was raving about it. But I've seen the movie twice now in a cinema and it's killed, which is good. And then I'm coming, I think on the 12th, and I'll acclimate for a few days and then go out to the Prince Charles and see everybody and hope people like it.
I'm sure they will. Jim, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I genuinely, congratulations on a phenomenal piece of work. I love it. The beta test is a very, very special, very funny, at times horrifying film, which is just the way it should be.
That's too kind. Alex, you're too kind. Thank you so much for having me, man.
Hey, been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, I was just speaking to the PR team who were talking to me about the movie. I'm going to try and make it down to the Prince of Wales. So maybe I can buy you a pint. Yeah. I'm going to come
down. I'd love that. Let's do it. Buy me a pint. I would love that.
I would love to. Hey, have a great day, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.